From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. As politicians fret these days about how to win female voters, and record numbers of women put themselves forth as candidates, it's worth remembering that a century ago, the big dispute was whether women should even have the right to vote. Suffragists persuaded some states to open the ballot to women, but by 1918 had turned their effort into amending the federal constitution to cover the whole country. Elaine Weiss has written The Woman's Hour, a fast-moving chronicle of the struggle among women's advocates, corporate lobbyists, and white supremacists.
And what was feared by some Southern anti-suffragists was that this would open up the floodgates and allow black women to vote.
The fight for the 19th Amendment on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. In the last five presidential elections, women have turned out to vote in higher proportions than men. Politicians worry about gender gaps and plan campaign strategies to appeal to female voters. This year, heading into the midterm elections, record numbers of women candidates are putting themselves forward. So it's worth pausing to remember that less than a century ago, the country was caught in a roiling, nasty, complicated fight over whether women should even have the right to step into the voting booth. Some women had been demanding that right for decades, but the right of women to vote was not locked into the U.S. Constitution until the 19th Amendment was ratified by 36 states in the summer of 1920. Baltimore writer Elaine Weiss describes in delicious detail how that came about, who pushed for and against, using what tricks and strategies, in her book The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And Elaine Weiss is here to tell us about it. Welcome back to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila.
So we've all heard that the 19th Amendment allowed women to vote, but the recent coverage of possible interference in the 2016 election has underscored for us that the states are in charge of voting, including who can register. So why was the fight in 1920 over a federal amendment?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You are completely correct that the states are in charge of election procedures, which is why we have some problems now with voter suppression in certain states. States are given the power to decide who of their citizens can vote. It can be superseded, however, in our federal system by a federal amendment. And so the suffragists, when organized demand for the vote began to be expressed in the mid-19th century, there were two tracks. The first track was to get each state to change their laws, because many of the state constitutions, including Maryland's, said that only men could vote. And in fact, in some states, like Maryland, it said in the Constitution only white men could vote. And so the 15th Amendment changed that in states like Maryland and made it male citizens could vote, striking out the white. At least legally. Of course, in fact, black men were being denied the vote through other means. So there were basically two tracks: get each state to change their constitutions, and that could be done by legislative action or by a referendum of the, of course, male voters deciding whether women deserve the vote. And the suffragists, throughout their seven-decade campaign, pursued both of those tracks, so that by 1920, there were actually about 15 states that did offer their women citizens some form of vote. In some states, it was complete voting privileges in all elections.
And they could vote in federal as well in, as state
well,
and local
yes,
elections.
Yes, but some of them were limited to just municipal elections. So it really depended how the state wanted to define it. And so Some states allowed it. Some allowed very limited representation so that, for instance, in some states, women could vote in municipal elections for their mayor, but could not vote for their governor, their Congress representative, senator, or representative. They couldn't vote for their state representatives. They couldn't vote where real power resided. So the suffragists began to, again, pursuing this dual track, began to concentrate on the federal amendment because that, in one fell swoop, would change the laws in every state it takes precedence. The problem is you have to get Congress to move and approve an amendment to the Constitution, and then you have to convince 36 states to ratify it. And that's where my story opens.
Right. Congress passed the 19th Amendment in June 1919 and sent it to the states. Maryland was one of the southern states whose legislatures rejected it that winter. By late summer 1920, 35 states had ratified. Only one more was needed, and there weren't many states left.
No, there weren't. And it was clear that either the states that were left were not going to ratify, Florida, North Carolina. And also there were two northeastern states where the governors just refused, under political and corporate pressure, refused to call their legislatures into special session. And so that they were not going to vote on it. And so it comes down to Tennessee. And of course, the suffragists are tearing out their hair because Tennessee isn't the easiest place or the best place to stage this definitive fight, and they know it. But they have very little choice. And they've waited. The federal amendment was caught in Congress for 42 years. It was ignored and tabled for 42 years. So it's finally out there. They're finally on the cusp of victory. But all the forces opposing suffrage now mobilize to try to thwart it at the finish line.
Before we talk a little bit about that mobilization, back up for sort of an overview. From our perspective now, it would be easy to assume that all women favored voting rights, that it must have been the men who opposed. And of course, as you pointed out, only men could actually vote on it. But the suffs and the antis, the pros and the cons, it really didn't line up entirely on gender lines.
No, it didn't. And that was one of the most startling research finds for me. I found it amazing and incredible, not in a good way, that women would organize themselves to oppose enfranchising their sisters. I couldn't understand how this could happen. Of course, when we look at modern politics, we can begin to see how that could happen. We see that sort of mobilization against what might be considered women voting in their self-interest, in the best interests of all women. And so I began to be able to understand. Of course, I wrote this book before the 2016 election, just as it was closing. And I guess that in hindsight, it explains some things to me now. But yes, there are women who very passionately refuse the idea that women should vote. And there are various reasons for it. Some are conservative in their social, cultural, and religious outlook. And because some ministers and priests and rabbis opposed women's suffrage, thinking it went against God's plan, because God had created the earth with Adam to be dominant over Eve. And so any change in that plan, any call for equality between the sexes, they felt went against biblical teaching. And so there were some women who really bought that and decided this was wrong, morally wrong. Others saw the danger of women entering into the public sphere. If they were asking for the vote, they're probably going to want to go out to work, to have careers, to leave their children at home. And their idea of the ideal American family was based upon a woman being at home. Of course, we haven't outgrown that completely. And that was one of their fears. And not a totally fabricated fear. That that did happen, but they saw it not as a positive. They saw it as a definite negative. Children were going to be neglected. The husbands were going to have to take care of the babies. This was portrayed as a terrible thing. So there was a sense that this was going to not only alter public life, political life of the nation, it was going to affect the private lives, the home lives of women and men. And so it becomes much more emotional, much more personal, and it takes on ramifications that are beyond just voting in their mind.
That's Baltimore writer Elaine Weiss here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, which details the struggle to win ratification of the 19th Amendment in the Tennessee legislature. She'll be speaking about it to the League of Women Voters luncheon on Saturday, September 15th. So much of the suffrage debate, not just in Tennessee, was about race and white supremacy. Give us the context. This was 55 years after the end of the Civil War.
Yes, it
was.
And
as you mentioned, it's about 50 years after the 15th Amendment established voting rights for black men.
Yes, the racial aspect is a dominant theme in the anti-suffrage campaign, and it comes up in the suffrage campaign, too. Black men had been given the vote after the Civil War. White women and black women had not. And both black and white women had decried that decision that Congress had made in 1868 and 1870 to not make women part of that universal, the ideal of universal suffrage. But of course, black men had soon been disenfranchised by Jim Crow laws, by state constitutions, by violence against them. They were intimidated. They were had to pay poll taxes. They were subjected to ridiculous, what we call literacy tests. Clearly, these were intimidation tactics, which were used successfully until the 1960s. So the idea was black men in the South had been disenfranchised already. And what was feared by some Southern anti-suffragists was that this would open up the floodgates and allow black women to vote, who they feared would vote in even greater numbers.
But this is what I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all trying to give short shrift to the violence and intimidation mm-hmm. that kept black men mm-hmm. from voting. Mm-hmm. But if white supremacists had managed to keep that from happening, why were they so terrified of black women nominally being given the vote?
Well, yes. I think there's a sense that it would be unseemly to physically attack and intimidate women. But in fact, when it comes down to it, after ratification, that is what happens in the southern states. And so, yes, it seems like, well, they were perfectly fine intimidating black men. I think they felt that it would they didn't want to have to deal with black women, too. And they certainly soon figured out ways to intimidate black women. But they did not want a whole nother class of African-American activists armed with the vote.
How much of this was an undercurrent of the suffrage debate, and how much was just said out loud on the floor of the legislature?
Oh, it's out loud. It's really quite outrageous, reading both the debates over ratification. First the debates in Congress about the federal amendment, then the debates in the states, especially the southern states. And I chronicle the kind of pure, blatant racist arguments being used in Tennessee in that last ratification fight.
And the suffragists advocating for their own vote did not push back.
They did not push back. They often used the idea that, well, if you give all women the vote, you know there are more white women than black women, even in the southern states. And so they, when they felt they needed to convince racist legislators in the southern states or racist southern congressmen in the Congress, they did use the race card. They did say, well, don't worry, you know, giving black women the vote is not going to disturb white supremacy. In fact, having white women vote will bolster it. And so there are times when the suffragists are using that same argument for their own case, which was disturbing to me to read, but it certainly is the historical record.
Another dynamic was the corporate interests, like the railroads. What did they see at stake?
Yeah, we don't think of women's suffrage as entering into all these other complex layers of policy, but it did. And so there were many corporations who felt that women voting would be bad for their business. The railroads, in particular, are just coming out of nationalization during World War I. They need their friends in Congress and in the state legislatures to cut beneficial deals. They've had these beneficial deals for years. That's how they were able to build transcontinental railway, and also all the local railways need right-of-ways. They need all kinds of gifts and benefits from the state. They've already pretty much bought off, for instance, the Tennessee legislature. And what the railroads fear is that putting this whole unpredictable new electorate, doubling the electorate and not knowing how women are going to vote, is going to upset their carefully laid plans and maybe elect people they haven't bought off yet and they don't know how they're going to vote. And so they see this. They want to preserve the status quo in both Congress and in the state legislatures. And so they really fight.
So given all these forces and the intense lobbying from all sides for every vote, I got to tell you, I find it really hard to believe that the deciding vote in the crucial tally was really one young delegate who'd planned to vote no until he got a letter from his mother and decided to vote the way she wanted. I find this implausible. You've researched it in great detail, but really? That's what got the 19th Amendment ratified?
Well, that is the moment when that one vote, which is preceded by another vote, which I chronicle by a man who also switches his vote. But of course, young Harry Byrne getting a letter from his mother and being accused of taking a bribe for doing this switch is very dramatic and is very true. I mean, I've seen the letter. I've read his statements about it. It is absolutely true. But you know how a legislature works. What is behind that, and which I try to report on, is all the maneuvers that allowed it to both get that close and keep the suffragists in line in the strength needed to even make it that close of a vote. The suffragists go in thinking they've got the votes. They have pledges from a majority of the representatives and senators in the Tennessee legislature. And those slowly over the course of the next 2 weeks when the legislature is in session, they're picked off. And the suffragists see their fortunes just erode. And
that is the suspense of the book. We need to take a quick break here on the record. When we're back with Elaine Weiss, author of The Woman's Hour, we'll talk about the movie and other 21st century applications. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore author Elaine Weiss has written such an engaging, suspense-filled account of how the 19th Amendment was ratified 98 years ago that it's been optioned for a movie. The book titled The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, is packed with colorful characters and legislative treachery. Hillary Clinton is to be co-executive producer of the project. Here's how the Boston Globe described it last month. Quote, she's teaming up with Steven Spielberg's Amblin Television for what will be either a TV movie or a limited series about the women's suffrage movement and the long fight to win the right to vote, close quote. Elaine, what's the story? It's going to be a movie, a TV movie, a series?
Well, I think some of the structure of it is yet to be determined. So that's being discussed now. It will be, I believe, a TV limited series is what's being talked about now. And it's very exciting, as you might imagine. Secretary Clinton found the book compelling, but more importantly to me, she found the lessons and the story of it to be important for Americans today to understand how this came about, how hard it was to win the right to vote, how precious it is. And so I think she saw in it some modern resonances that are important for now.
You did such careful research for The Woman's Hour. Is it scary to think of passing it into other hands?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Will you have any role in the project, do you know?
I am also an executive producer, and I'll certainly give any advice they're willing to take. But again, it's being translated into another medium, and I have to respect the creative process there. But I will certainly be giving them advice on what is historically rings true and what doesn't.
Steven Spielberg, of course, produced the movie Lincoln 5 years ago about the deals that went into Congress passing the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery. And people said the details didn't necessarily match history, but the gist of the story did.
Yes, I saw that. And I remember seeing that film just as I was beginning working on my book and realizing, yes, and certainly Doris Kearns Goodwin did a magnificent job of describing that in her book, Team of Rivals. So I think historians are very protective of their subjects and of their themes. And I'm confident that we will be giving a very true and powerful interpretation of this moment in history.
What would you identify as the unfinished business of the fight for the 19th Amendment?
Oh, I think it's very clear, especially as we're approaching elections in the next few weeks. It's protecting the vote for all citizens. Women have the vote, but some women and some men are being denied it by very overt voter suppression techniques and unlawful suppression in many ways in many states. And this gets expressed almost every day. I read about another way that a state is trying to limit the voting access of minority communities. We've seen it here in Maryland. We've seen it. I just read about a Georgia district which has closed many of its voting booths in minority districts, or there aren't enough voting machines. The idea that voter rolls are being purged, and we're not clear what those, how they're being purged. And so there are a lot of different ways that states are making it more difficult for voters to exercise the most precious right of a democracy. And so that, I think, we have to be very vigilant about in this coming election and all others. We're nervous about the Russians, but I am actually more nervous about those in our country who want to limit expression of the franchise. And so that's what I'm worried about.
Most of those efforts you talk about are aimed at racial minorities, as you mentioned, not really at women.
No, but women who are in those racial minorities certainly suffer. It's true, women outperform men at the ballot box. More women vote than men vote. But our participation levels are really dreadful. They are not what they should be. People take it for granted, or they think their vote doesn't count, or they think it's not going to make a difference. And we've seen all these elections lately where it hinges on maybe one vote in every district. So it really does count, and it's our responsibility to both protect the vote and to encourage everyone to exercise it. We can't have a democracy if only a few people vote.
Elaine Weiss, thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Baltimorean Elaine Weiss is the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. She's speaking about it several times this week. Lunch tomorrow at the Hamilton Street Club in the Mount Vernon neighborhood, dinner Thursday evening at the Johns Hopkins Club on the Homewood campus, and Saturday at the League of Women Voters of Baltimore City luncheon, 11 a.m., at the Church of the Holy Redeemer, 5603 North Charles Street. We have links to all three events at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Happy you're with us. Tune in tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.